Oh, it doesn't match today.
The HISS meeting is convened and was called to order at 3:04 on February 28th, 2008. And let the record reflect that Representative Keller, Representative Gardner, Representative Seaton, Representative Roses, and myself, Wilson, are present. So we do have a quorum to conduct business. Before we get started, I'd like to recognize the staff today. Debbie Tillinghast is our House Recording Secretary, and Sammy Kaneen is our LIO moderator. And my right hand back here in the corner is Becky Rooney, our committee aide, and also Representative Fairclough has joined us. So before we start, please turn off your cell phones because they do interfere with our instruments up here. Don't put them on buzz. Just go ahead and shut them off. We did have three bills on our agenda today, but one of them has been House Bill 304, Cancer Drug Repository, was postponed by request of the sponsor. So we will hear today two bills, House Bill 50, Child Placement Compact, and House Bill 354, Hard to Place Child Subsidy / Child Support. So we're going to hear House Bill 50 first. We did hear it last week, and we do have version E before us. So, Reneva, do you want to come forward and bring whoever you want with you? And we did hear this last week, so we're just going to kind of re-summarize and see what you have for us.
Thank you, Chairman Wilson. For the record, Reneva Moss, staff for Representative Coghill. I guess I would comment that I thought Marcia did an excellent job of going through the House Bill 50. In layman's terms, it was refreshing not hearing all of the legal jargon that's involved with compacts. So I guess at this point I would just open it up for questions, and between Marcia and I we'll try to get answers for you. I know there was one question from Representative Cisna's office addressing amendments to the compact. This is a compact that has to be passed by 35 states to go into effect, so it is a take-all or nothing proposition.
Okay. Well, that takes care of that. And Representative Cisna is just joining us. Did you, by any chance, hear the answer to that, Representative Cisna? Mm-hmm. Reneva just told us there was a question about amendments to the bill on the compact, and does anyone have any questions on this bill left over from last week, or any new ones that you want to go over at all? Representative Seaton.
So Madam Chair, we have the CS before us, which is the CS we talked about, incorporates everything from last time. This isn't a new CS.
No, this is the same. Representative Gardner.
Just to refresh my mind, the Attorney General's objections were to the initial version and
through
not to the
Representative
current.
Gardner, that's correct.
And so those objections are no longer in place?
To the best of my knowledge, no.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? So what do we need to do? We just need to just accept this and pass it on out, or?
Madam Chair, yes, it would be to for the committee to pass out House Bill, or committee substitute for House Bill 50 HESS with the accompanying fiscal note, which the department had initially submitted a fiscal note that had fiscal impact in FY09 and FY010, which they were not taking in consideration the fact that 34 other states have to adopt it, and it'll probably be at least 2 years before there's any fiscal impact at all. That fiscal impact, Marcia could explain better, but once 35 states have adopted it, then the representative from each state will have to get together, and regulations will have to be drafted so we can put the compact into effect. And Marcia, if you want to address that further.
For the record, this is Marcia Pickering with the Office of Children's Services. I suspect that it will take 2 years to get 35 states to sign on to this compact, and then the representatives, when they get to, we're going to work off the old or the current regulations that we have for the next 12 months. In that time, the Interstate Commission will get together and come up with what they perceive to be the rules. And they're going to be doing the bylaws. They're going to be looking at the dues structure for each state. So it might be, it might be 2 years to get it enacted, but it might be three before we really know about how much it's going to cost us.
Representative Gardner?
On a slightly different subject, I have a question for Marcia Pickering, and that is, on the whole, does Alaska send out more children than are sent to us?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, yes. It's a two-thirds, one-third.
Thank you.
We send out twice as many requests as we get in.
And Madam Chair, and just to clarify, once we've sent a child out in compliance with the ICPC, our responsibilities are finished and we continue to monitor and...
Representative Gardner, that once we've placed under an ICPC placement agreement, we maintain jurisdiction through the life of that placement until the child is 18 years old, is adopted, goes into a guardianship, returns, or is if placement is with the parent, then the ICPC could close when the custody is released back to the parent. So we're financially, medically responsible for the life of the placement.
Follow-up?
Thank you, yes. And so for the day-to-day management of that particular case, is there not a social worker in the receiving state or whatever is needed there, and simply the state of Alaska just pays the bill? Is that?
Under the placement agreement, the receiving state provides supervision services. So supervision referral, they'll make the home visits, they'll write up the supervision reports, and they'll provide it to us. We still maintain primary case management responsibilities. We're using a secondary to follow through with what's needed.
Okay, thank you.
Now, you're going to have to refresh my memory because I can't remember what ICPC means.
It means?
Okay. All right. I was trying to think if it was some organization inside the OCS. I was thinking, I can't remember what it was. Okay. All right. Any other questions? Is there anyone online that would not? Okay. And is there anyone in the audience that wants to testify on this? Then we will close testimony. And what's the wishes of the committee?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would move House Bill 50, committee substitute for House Bill 50, version E, with individual recommendations. I guess there wouldn't be any. And attached fiscal notes.
All right. Hearing no objection, so moved. Don't forget to sign the packet. All right. Now we're going to go on to House Bill 50. And House Bill...
That was 354.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. That bill that we just had goes on to judiciary next. Okay. House Bill 354. And actually, after Hess, House Bill 354 goes to judiciary and then finance. Okay, hard to place child subsidy and child support, and this is the first time that we've heard this bill. And we have a CS, and so would someone like to move version C?
So moved.
Okay, so now we have version C before us. Reneva, we'll go ahead and let you present the bill so that we have a good idea of what exactly this bill is telling us.
Madam Chair, for the record again, Reneva Moss, Representative Coghill's office. This bill was brought to us by Office of Children's Services to address a couple of issues that they had. One was with child support for minors in custody of OCS and with juvenile justice. As far as gaining child support order to get child support from the parents while the child was in custody receiving state services. Under existing child support laws, parents can go to child support and get order changes on custody without having to go to court. An oversight of that has been discovered, and OCS doesn't have that same process where they can get administrative orders. They have to go to court. So this would change that so that they could, by administrative order, also get orders changed. And then they also found through the potential of court cases, and Department of Law can talk to this better than I can, that the wording in the existing state statute, if you look on page 3 of the CS, section 4, they're changing the language so that there are situations where there is no need for a subsidy for a hard to place child, but under the existing language, it is assumed that there would be a subsidy from the day of birth. So they have some legal issues with that. This also addresses two different issues, one which came up from a family law attorney in Fairbanks, where an 18-year-old thought that since he was 18 years old, he could go through the process to be adopted by his stepfather, who had raised him for 18 years. He had never met his father. His father was never in the picture. And he discovered that when he was 18, because of a contradiction in law, until he was 19, he still had a legal obligation to pursue location of his father and give him parental notification. This changes that. Once the child is 18, once it's evident that the father has not been in the child's life, the 18-year-old does have legal permission to be adopted without tracking down the missing parent and getting parental consent. And then the last thing it does is it addresses Representative Guerra's concern about civil liability on the part of OCS. And, Madam Chair, I apologize. I don't have an amendment prepared. However, I do have a memo from Department of Law that would address an amendment to this CS that is agreeable to Representative Guerra as a fix for his concerns for civil liability when a child is injured or dies because of negligence on the part of OCS.
Okay. Is that saying that someone can sue the state then?
Mm-hmm. Clarifies that the state is not exempt from civil liability if a child dies in state custody or is injured in state custody, and it's because of negligence on the part of a state worker. And Department of Law is here to address that.
Okay. Well, maybe Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 3, starting in line 22 there, this is on section 4. I'm trying to figure out, you know, on the first part of that, on lines 14, 15, that the can determine the length of the subsidy for a hard-to-place child, but in section C, that's modified so that the subsidy may not exceed the existing rate for foster care.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, this is put in to do a couple of things. First of all, it changes that decision from the commissioner, one individual, to the department, so that could be a determination by someone besides the commissioner. The other thing it does is it allows them to say, while this says it may not exceed the rate for foster care, this allows them to say there is no need for services. Let's say it's a newborn child. There's no evidence of anything wrong with a newborn child. This allows it so that the placement cannot assume that just because it's a hard-placed child, there is going to be a subsidy involved. In other words, it could be no subsidy at all until the child reaches the age of 3 and it becomes apparent that there may be fetal alcohol syndrome or other things involved that would require a subsidy for that child.
And follow-up
representative.
And I guess, Madam Chair, you know, that I fully agree with that, but I'm trying to figure out the subsidy rate for a hard-to-place child is limited to basically no more than you would give for a regular foster child.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, and I'll have Jan come up to help me with this, but there are other things involved besides the foster care rate. There is counseling, there's medical expenses involved. This is just for room and board, the foster care subsidy. All the other subsidies go a case-by-case basis on what the child actually needs.
So, but I guess what I'm trying to figure out is that I don't understand the system well enough. That it seems like for, if we're saying that we have a subsidy for a hard-to-place child, one that's probably going to need more, and we're saying that the subsidy can't exceed the base foster care rate, is what I'm understanding, so that we're saying that even the most difficult child, we're going to limit the state subsidy to the base foster care rate is the way I read this, and I don't know if I'm
through the chair,
reading.
Representative Seaton, I just got through saying I enjoyed not hearing all this legal jargon, but I'm about to turn this over to an attorney.
No.
Representative Gardner has something to
real quick on that point. Is it, am I correct in my understanding that when we're talking about the subsidy payment, we're not talking about foster care, we're talking about guardianship or adoption, we're talking about a long-term permanent placement?
And
Thank you. Okay.
For the record, I'm Jan Rutherdale, Assistant Attorney General. And through the chair, or to address Representative Seaton's questions, first off, this came from the federal government, and the idea of federal subsidies is we want to have permanency for children. And so what was they found out what was happening is children were in foster care, and prospective adoptive parents, those foster parents, didn't want to adopt because they'd lose all their money. And so this was a way for them to say, don't worry, we'll give you money to care for your child. But the federal rules, and that's we're stuck with them, I mean, those are the federal rules, say you can't have it more than, it cannot exceed the amount. You're not going to get a profit for, once you adopt the child, you're not going to get more money than you would have as a foster parent. So that's the cap. But that's distinguished from if those, that's the amount that the federal government is going to pay you to take care of your child. I mean, I don't get paid by the federal government to take care of my child, but for hard-to-place children, that's what the federal government is deciding to do. But if the child has special needs and needs special services, that's apart from what the parent, the now adoptive parent, gets paid to care for the child or the guardian. And so if that child needs services, that child is going to get services. If all children, and I hope I'm correct about this, but all children that are considered hard to place will get Medicare. And so that's going to, or Medicaid. Anyway, that's going to give them the medical expenses. And then if there's anything above and beyond that, then that's what will be decided in this subsidy. And it's something that's negotiated between the state and the foster parent or the soon-to-be adoptive parent or guardian. And it's fluid. If the child, as the child gets older, needs more services, they can come back and say, "I think we need to pay for more services here." And so it actually protects the parent because it can't be negotiated. The total amount of the subsidy can't be negotiated downward, but without the parent's consent, the adoptive parent's consent. But they can come back and say, "We need more money because as the child's getting older, there's more services." And so that's just a background of how the whole system works. But with respect to this bill, this is just a cleanup action because in regulation, the department had this provision that was saying for kids that are 0 to 3 years old, sometimes their problems aren't apparent. And so we want to protect, we don't want to just have the adoptive parent or guardian just go out there and Reneva Moss said, if turns out the child was a fetal alcohol syndrome disorder and that comes out only when they're 3 or older, when they start going to school, we don't want to punish that foster parent. We want to keep the door open for that adoptive parent to come back and say, you know, there's these problems now. I need more money to deal with this. So it's basically saying in certain amount of cases when the child doesn't have, at that moment in time that the child's adoptive, they don't have any documented medical problems, it's saying we're gonna give you a subsidy, but the subsidy amount at this time is going to be zero. But at a later time, if you come back and show that there's additional needs, then we will give you more money. We'll give you some money to address those needs.
I would think all the parents would just give their kids up when they get to teenagers and say, we need more money. Representative Roses.
Thank you. And I appreciate the explanation, and I understood 99% of it. But where I was having the concern that Representative Seaton brought up is that the appearance of a conflict. And so when you look on page 3 and you start on line 13 with the section A there, it says that the department is going to set the amount, length of time of the subsidy. But then down here under C it says, but it can't exceed that amount. So you can only set that length of time and subsidy as so long as it's under that amount. Is that correct?
Yeah, and that's okay. True. It's
not
zero,
a conflict.
Yeah, it's zero to that.
Zero to that amount.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now I have a question. If this is just automatic for every adoption because you don't know if they're going to be hard to place. I mean, they might look perfectly normal until they're 3, and then all at once you realize that they've got some problems you didn't know before.
Yeah, there's a lot of regulations that specifically set out, and it's very, you know, you have to show that the child is, I mean, they just have a lot of criteria. And so, for example, there may be something that qualifies the child for a subsidy. It could be a deferred subsidy. For example, one of the criteria is, and this is something that is in the federal regulation, is Native children are considered hard to place, and so that in and of itself might qualify. Or, for example, a sibling group, because there's a great desire to keep siblings together. Because there's so many of them, that may be a hard to place sibling group, and so that might qualify them for some amount of subsidy. But what the statute says, or what the regulations say, is to actually get to kick it into actual money when the child is from 0 to 3, to actually have money at the point of adoption, you have to meet this other threshold, which is that the child definitely has special needs at that time. And if you can't meet that, then they give this deferred subsidy, which says come back in 3 years, and if you can show at that time that the child is have special needs, then we can negotiate. And I may not have it exactly. It may be that if they can come back sooner than 3 years, but that's the gist of it.
Okay, and then what?
And the reason we're here today is because the original statute said that the state can have some, the state can negotiate some monetary amount up to the cost of the foster care rate. And so they realize that that's in conflict with the regulation that says it can be a zero amount. And so this is just clarifying that it can be a zero amount. It doesn't mean they don't get any services, because like Renita explained, you could have a you qualify for Medicaid. That's a huge financial benefit to the parents. They pay for your adoption expenses. You know, there's other things you can qualify for, but the actual amount of payment for a subsidy to take care of that child may be a zero amount at that time. So that's the only reason. That's the bottom line.
Okay. Representative Garden?
Thank you. And just for the committee members, really, there are a lot of foster parents who might be interested in adopting a child, but their concern is that they can't afford to be fully responsible for that child. So this whole setup is an effort to make it possible for people who want and are willing to take long-term responsibility to not have to also shoulder what could be unknown and very expensive responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So
including legal liability. For, I mean, you get a kid who's a really disturbed child, and at 15 could be out setting fires and stealing cars, and all of a sudden you have all kinds of problems. So,
so then they even get help with the, if they have to go to court or something?
I don't, I'm not sure. I know guardians have, I think there is a provision about guardians. Oh. I'm not sure about adoptive parents.
Madam Chair, Mike Lessman is here from the department that may be able to explain to you how the department handles cases like these.
Mike, why don't you just pull a chair up and we might have some more questions here.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Lessman. I'm the Community Relations Manager and Legislative Liaison for the Office of Children's Services. And I'm sorry, Madam Chair, but could I have the question again?
Well, we were talking about the reason why they had this, because if somebody was a foster parent and they wanted to adopt the child, but they knew that probably there were some problems coming down the pike, and they so they were kind of worried about that. This is going to take care of that. And now, if they adopted a child, but there doesn't seem to be too much going on now, do we take the foster money away and then just let them be parents like everybody else until there's starting to be problems, and then we go back and help them out? Kind of what happens. Can you walk us through a scenario?
Madam Chair,
Representative
Gardner. Give me just a second. I think what you just referred to is what they're defining as a deferred subsidy, where the parents say, I don't need anything right now. I just want to hold out that if this child needs residential treatment and long-term care, I don't have to sell my house to be able to take care of him. And then they can come back to the state and say, I do need help. I didn't then, but I do now.
Yeah, but I just kind of want to know what happens in a normal situation with the hard-to-place child. Kind of walk us through that scenario.
Madam Chair, I don't know if there is a normal situation. You know, I guess there are factors you have to consider, the age of the child, the special needs that are already diagnosable and on the record and known to the foster parent, prospective adoptive parent, the child's caseworker. Pardon me, but I thought I heard a question in here about a potential liability for an adoptive parent down the road.
And yeah, that was one question.
Okay. And so I might have to make a note and say I'm going to get back to the committee on this, but I believe that there was, as of a couple of legislative sessions ago, I believe there was law on the books that gave the adoptive parent of a hard-to-place child liability for damages, just same as guardians. But I need to, with confidence, I'd want to get back to you on that.
Okay. All right. Any other questions from the committee? They all understand it better than I do, I think, yes.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
So basically, the structure we're looking at is hard-to-place children often remain in foster care, and this is an attempt to clarify and to move them into adoptive situations and protect the adoptive parent from unknown liabilities that might occur because of some situation with the child. Is that basically what this whole thing is revolving around?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I would say yes. Sir.
Okay.
Yes.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton.
And that's Jan Luther?
Rutherdale. Yes.
Yeah, Rutherdale.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to clarify that this bill is really doesn't go that far in the sense that. It's true that there's a mechanism out there for these hard-to-place children and make sure they get some money and all that sort of thing, but this particular bill is the bottom line of it is it's strictly a cleanup to go to change the word some monthly amount, which to us implies that there has to be, whether it's $1 a month, it has to be something to allow us to have the authority to do what the regulations is already doing, which is having that zero amount for those first 3 years until we know more about where this child is going. And that's really, it's just a cleanup, strictly, very small point. That's it.
All right. Any other questions?
And maybe if I could, I'd add that also the child support enforcement changes was also a cleanup that CSSD is already doing administrative orders. But we noticed in our statute it said only the court could grant this. Well, CSED has been doing it administratively for years. So it's, again, just a cleanup.
All right. Thank you. Now, I kind of think that we've got some people online that would like to testify, so I think I'll go to testimony. And Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I just have a question about child support. And is there some change? I'm sorry, I'm not sure how I want to say this, but is there some change in here dealing with child support, or is that just incidentally in the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, this does address child support, as Jan just brought out. Under current statute, parents can get administrative orders to change child support. And although I won't repeat what Jan said, the law doesn't allow for OCS to use that same administrative authority in statute. It does in regulation.
Thank you.
Right. Let's go online. We have two people online, and Chad Hutcherson, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Would you like to state your name and affiliation, and then give us your testimony?
Sure. My name is Chad Hutcherson. I work for Cook, Schumann, and Grossclose up in Fairbanks. I am a family law attorney, and our firm was the one that approached Representative Coghill about making some changes to adoption statutes, specifically 2523050 and 2523100. And I'm here to voice my support for CSHB 354.
And had you come into, had to, did you have to represent someone or to, I mean, why did you decide that they need to be changed?
Let me kind of briefly explain. I thought the Representative Coghill's agent did a good job, but I want to kind of make it a little more in-depth for you. Basically, a family walked into my office. This includes a mom and her son and their stepfather. The stepfather is an Iraq war vet. He's getting ready to get shipped off in September of 2008 back to Iraq. And as a gift, he wanted to adopt his son that he's basically raised since he's been born, even though he's not the biological father. Okay. The son's biological father impregnated the mom down in California, and then when she told him that she was pregnant, he takes off and is never heard from again. So the guy falls off the face of the earth. On the birth certificate, when the son is actually born, it says unknown. She knows the name of the guy, but she can't contact him. He doesn't want to have anything to do with her. So shortly after, she meets the stepfather. They get married, and the stepfather has raised the son for the past 18 years, essentially. The stepfather is the only father that the son has ever known. Okay, so this is the background. We present the adoption paperwork on behalf of the stepfather to the court, and the court gives us a ruling that says that even though these are the circumstances of the case, even though these are what every single person in this case has sworn to in an affidavit, that the biological father has never had contact with the son, they still said that we were required to give notice. So what that means is the stepfather is going to have to spend the time and the money to publish notice in San Jose, California, which is the last known address of the biological father 18 years ago, okay? And the fact of the matter is the notice would have just said the initials. The deadbeat dad had seen the notice, there's a very, very, very low probability that he would ever want to have anything to do with this boy or come back and contest it. So the problem that we had was addressed by the attorneys at our firm, and we all came together and we looked at why this happened. And one of the reasons this happened is because there's conflicting language in the statutes, and that's something that we think should change, and I think Representative Coghill has agreed with us on this. And this specifically, we're talking about 25-23-050, A7 is the first one, and then 25-23-100. And we were hoping to add section K to it, basically saying if a biological parent has abandoned the kid and there's been no contact whatsoever, then you still don't have to go back. You don't have to go back and give notice. You don't have to punish the step parent who's doing everything he can to try and adopt the poor kid in light of the circumstances. So that's the things that we wanted to change. We also wanted to change the fact that, in our view, an 18-year-old is an adult. He's old enough to join the Army. He's old enough to vote. He's old enough to decide who he wants to get adopted to. And the way the statute was written before, it said that this is 25-23-050. This is the current version as it is now. It says a parent of the person to be adopted, if the person is 19 more years of age, which we believe is just a holdover from ancient Alaska law, and then continuing it says, and the court dispenses with the consent of the parent. Well, why does the biological parent have any say at this point? I mean, the adult, is 18, and he should be able to decide who he wants to get adopted to. So that was basically our position, and if you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them for you. This is, like I said, the application of these statutes in the real world is kind of put this family in particular in a very awkward situation. I think it needs to change.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. That explained it pretty well. Representative Gardner has a question.
Okay.
And can we get the rest of the story?
The rest of the story, yeah. Well, the rest of the story is still ongoing, so I can give you an update in a couple months here. But hopefully, with your help, we can make the changes on these statutes, and I think it'll be for the betterment of all adoption cases throughout Alaska. So.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Craig Partika?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead and state your name and affiliation.
Okay, Craig Partika. I'm a family law attorney in Fairbanks at Cook, Schumann & Gross Close. And I was one of the other attorneys who worked with Mr. Hutchison, and I basically agreed with everything he said. He summarized the particular circumstance which brought this issue to light very well. And I agree with the proposed change, and I support it. And I would just point out, though, I do have some reservations. I've been an attorney for 8 years. That's a little bit longer than Mr. Hutchison, but not as long as some other attorneys in our office. So I'm kind of in the middle of the career experience. And in that experience, I do have, or I have had occasion where, person A says X, and then person Y says, no, it's not X, it's something else. They're talking about the same event, and they're seeing the same event in what seem to be completely contradictory terms. And I've talked with Mr. Hutchison about this, and on balance, I think the changes are okay. But my concern, though, is that a person could come in to court. There would be a final adoption hearing where that person would have to testify as to the no contact by the biological father, and that there was no support by the biological father, therefore no notice to the biological father. But of course, we're only getting one side of the story. And so if there's any reservation, I think that it is still unnoticed. The statute was written to, first, in this one section, 050, it says, notice is not required, but in little paragraph B in the statute, it says, except as provided in section 100. And then section 100 says, well, you do have to provide notice in almost every situation under 050, except paragraphs 4 and 5. So a parent who has consented to the adoption, you don't have to give that person notice. Or a parent whose parental rights have been terminated, you don't have to give that person notice. But every other circumstance which the statute lists, you do have to give notice. And what we're saying is, do you really have to give notice if the person's been abandoned? And that's kind of this year. We got the one-year time frame from the statute already talks about a period of a year. It also talks about a period of 6 months, but I'm not going to go into that. And it just seems like, you know, notice should not be required if there's been no contact and no support for that long. And all I'll say again is, since I've heard one person say one thing, and you come in, maybe that, you know, the other side of the story is contradictory. So maybe the person doesn't get notice and the child gets adopted out, and maybe that person did have contact, but the petitioner has not either seen the facts differently, you know, to put it in a positive way. So I think, you know, the reason why I support it, though, is it says no contact. And I tend to think that overall a person swearing in front of a judge, and a judge would have the opportunity to question that person. But if the person swears under oath in court that the biological father has had none, you know, a contact with the child, then that kind of circumstance, I think, does warrant moving forward in a speedier fashion, one that's cheaper for the person who's going to adopt the child, without this sort of legal fiction of actually giving notice. As Mr. Hutchison pointed out, you publish in some paper where you think the person is, you list the initials of the child. The person, if he ever, by some miracle, was actually reading that, would not know by the initials that that was the person who he had, you know, given or had was the father of. So the notice is not really calculated to actually give notice. It's more of a legal fiction. When you put all of this together, I kind of come out on balance of supporting the changes.
Okay, thank you very much. And Representative Gardner has a question.
Thank you. And thank you very much for your description there. If it were to happen that somebody claimed that the biological father had had no contact, and then later on, you know, the adoption goes through, and then it's found that actually the absent parent had had contact and the person had lied, would that be grounds for overturning the adoption?
Well, under normal rules, Rule 60B in the civil rules allows 1 year to overturn a judgment for fraud. And so the one thing, though, I think that would still apply in the adoption realm, but I would have to check as to whether, I'm pretty sure it does. I think there's some special exceptions when there's native children, but that would be something maybe the other committee, the Judiciary Committee, could double check. I know that rule generally applies, and unless there's some reason why it wouldn't in adoption, if it's specifically stated that it doesn't apply, then it should apply, and then that person would have a year to file what we call a 60B motion. And if the judge believes them, then they would be able to overturn that decree.
Thank you.
I often wondered if, you know, wonder if the father never, ever made any contact whatsoever because the woman moved away and he didn't have a clue where she moved. And so there was just no way for him to get in contact, and he wanted to, but he didn't because he couldn't.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In response to that, I'd say, yeah, and I think that could conceivably happen. But on the other hand, the rights of the parent who doesn't know anything about this mm-hmm. is balanced by the rights of the child to have a long-term stable placement and not to have that disturbed by a total stranger.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I guess my question is, let's say it was somebody that's 30 years old and is being adopted. Are you saying that there should be some notification?
That question is to me. Mr. Yeah. Martinez? Yeah. No, because that person, let's see, that would be paragraph 7. So the parental consent would not be required. And when you go back under 100, actually, under 100, paragraph 7 is listed as a condition where notice is required. Oh, but who has not consented? I might have to think about that one a little bit. But that,
Madam Chair,
I would say the answer should be that you know, no notice should be required.
Madam Chair,
Reneva,
through the chair, a 30-year-old would not be required to have notification because he is 19 years of age and older.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Following up on that, what I'm trying to figure out is if we're saying a 30-year-old is an adult and therefore their parental notice is not required, and if 18 is the age of adulthood in the state, why are we even talking about this? Because the person is legally an adult as the person is 30 years old. So we're not talking about a child that's under 18. The only change here is to take it to the age of adulthood. And so, we can talk about child, but we're really talking about an adult. And so I think that if we look at it, where the age 19 has no, shouldn't have any legal effect in Alaska because that person's already an adult. And so it makes no sense to me to, in any case, have someone that's 18 unless there's a competency or some other factor that the court has taken, custody of the person for some other factor. I mean, it just seems that it's logical to have the, when somebody's an adult, they can make all the decisions themselves without notifying a parent for anything they want to do. And we have this little glitch that says, you're an adult, but you can't make the decision on your own. It's just changing to the age of adulthood, and I don't see any problem at all.
Okay, any other questions?
Alternatively, have an amendment that changes.
Okay, is there anyone in the room that would like to testify?
Madam Chair, we do have counsel from Department of Law to discuss the amendment.
All right, so I'm going to close testimony then because I see no one in the room that wants to testify, so I'm going to close testimony. And now we'll let the department come up and tell us why we need this amendment.
Oh, ma'am.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
May not make the amendment first.
Oh, well, it doesn't matter. I matter.
My name is Susan Cox. I'm also an assistant attorney general like Jan Rutherdale. And I'm here to speak to the amendment that Ms. Moss has had passed out to you. This is in the proper format, but is taken from a proposal that our office drafted today for Representative Guerra after a meeting we had. And essentially, the amendment would add a subsection B to an existing statute, which is Alaska Statute 4710960. The bill before you would make changes in Section 7 and 8. We would not be playing with the existing language in 4710960 with the Section 7 amendment, and so that would be deleted. We would be deleting Section 8 and instead replacing it with what is in the handwritten amendment that's been passed out to you. Essentially, what this attempts to do, the current statute, 4710960, was originally drafted with a redraft of the child protection laws in 1998 to make it clear that someone could not bring a tort lawsuit for damages based on failure to follow one of the provisions in Title 47. It was never intended to prevent someone from being able to file a lawsuit if a child in state custody was harmed by a state actor. It only made it clear that all of the mandatory provisions in the child protection laws did not themselves create new bases for civil lawsuits. And so there was a provision in, well, that's where 4710-960 originated in 1998. It was reworded in an amendment in 2005. And we agree that the intent of the language in the existing statute was not intended to prevent anyone from being able to file a lawsuit on behalf of a child in state custody who is harmed while in state custody, or if the child dies in state custody. And so this would, this amendment before you would add a subsection B to the existing statute and make that point clear in the state statutes. We believe that is an accurate statement of current law, and we have no problem with that being added to the statute.
Okay, now you have explained why you want an amendment. Okay, now we've passed the amendment around, and would someone like to move the amendment? Representative Roses.
I'd move amendment number one. Okay. It would be page 4, lines 17 through 19.
All right. I'll object for discussion.
All right, and Representative Seaton, you had a question.
Yes, looking at these two provisions, they seem almost the same, except that, what's it?
That's what I thought.
Except that in the proposed amendment, if someone can sue on behalf of a child who might be dead, and in the other one, it doesn't have that restriction. Can you, from law, tell me what these things are different, or is
through the chair, Representative Seaton. Yes, the what you see in the committee substitute work draft C, section 7 and 8, you have the existing language is 4710-960. The purpose of that, what is in existing law, is to say that the statutes in Title 47 don't create a new basis for liability, an independent basis for liability. And that's what we would refer to as a duty. They don't create a tort duty that you can use as a basis for a lawsuit. And what you've got in Section 8 is something that's supposed to modify that says the state is not immune. The concepts of whether there is a basis for suing and whether the state is immune are actually not the same thing. They are two different doctrines. And so we have reworded this in the amendment that's before you to be legally more accurate and more consistent with the intent of Representative Guerra, which is to say what we have in statute is an accurate statement still. Failure to comply with something in Title 47 does not itself create a basis for liability. But, B, you can still file a negligence action or a wrongful death action. That is the reference to 955-580. If a child in state custody is injured or dies. So it is just legally a more accurate and less confusing way to state what Representative Guerra was trying to accomplish, and which Representative Coghill has now incorporated into this bill.
Follow up, Representative Seaton.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just curious on the constraint of filing on behalf of a child. Does that mean that, can you give me the parameters of then who can sue? Can they just, anybody can see a problem and can file a suit based on the death of a child?
Representative, through the chair, if there was a death of a child in state custody, or anyone's death for that matter, and a state would have to be represented by a personal representative if they were going to file a wrongful death action, whether it's against the state or anyone else. And normally, the court has to appoint a personal representative. So it couldn't be just anybody suing. It would have to be someone the court approved. That's often a relative. If they have an next of kin, it wouldn't necessarily be the natural parent. If their parental rights have been terminated, it would vary depending on the circumstances. I think the Representative Guerra's original purpose in the language that was drafted for House Bill 377 and is now incorporated here was simply to say that to permit lawsuits on behalf of, or when a child dies or is injured in state custody, and we're trying to accomplish the same thing here.
Okay. Now, just so I understand, in this version C that we're looking at, line 17 to 19 is what Representative Guerra wanted added in, but you've just looked at it and said you really want it worded a little different.
Through the chair, the amendment that Ms. Moss has passed out to you would delete what is in Section 7. We would leave 4710960 alone, and then we would add a B, which is the language she has passed out to you. So essentially, we would replace what she's given you as a new B for 4710960 and delete what's in the bill as seven and, Section 7 and 8.
You didn't answer my question.
Lawyers.
Can you answer that question, Reneva?
Yeah, I think I can. This 4710960 is language that Representative Coghill and I have been trying to deal with for 10 years now, because when originally what 960 said before it was amended in 2005 is that the department did not have a duty or standard of care for children in state custody.
Okay, right.
And that is one of the reasons Representative Coghill ran for
it. Just came on.
And it was because of House Bill 375, which passed in 1998, which adopted all these federal requirements that were placed on Alaska in order to get everything from Medicaid to child support money, et cetera. The state does have immunity. It's a sovereign entity, so it does have immunity. So you're always very cautious about saying it doesn't have immunity, because that could mean they're giving up their immunity. And we're trying to prevent that, but we are trying to hold the state accountable. When they have a child in state custody and that child is injured or results in death. So we want them held accountable, but we don't want them to give up their immunity, because there are certain provisions in state statute that say, yes, you have your immunity, but if you're negligent or if there's a wrongful death, you can be held accountable to the people of Alaska, to the child, to the child's parents, to the child's relatives. That's basically what it says.
Okay, now I'm just going to go through a scenario here. Child's in foster care, child's riding bicycle, falls off the bicycle, breaks his leg, and they have trouble with it, doesn't heal right or whatever. Where is it that it says that's just kind of the normal thing that might have happened and that wasn't somebody's fault? And so how do we deal with what then, how bad hurt do they have to be or whatever?
Madam Chair, there was no act of negligence. There was other party involved besides the child. If a foster parent shoved the child and the child fell and got hurt,
gotcha,
that would be a case of negligence.
Gotcha. Okay. Representative Roses and then that partner.
Just a point of clarification, since I made the amendment number one and moved it, I would want to make sure that was understood to be conceptual, so that if there was a section that had to be deleted, that this could be taken care of before it moves on to the next committee. So I just want to make sure that was conceptual.
Okay. And Representative Gardner.
I would just like to say that I think if a foster parent shoved a child and the child got hurt, that's not negligence unless the parent had a history of injuring children and the department failed to look into that. That's negligence.
I was trying to not get dramatic and say pushed him out on the street and he got hit or something like that. It would have to be an intentional act that the person knew that what they did could cause injury or death to a child.
And I just want to clarify that when we're specifying civil liability, we're not in any way, since we're specifying civil liability, we're not giving immunity for criminal liability by not including criminal liability.
Through the chair, no, this bill does not affect any kind of criminal responsibility or accountability. And actually, this bill, the amendment, would not affect immunity. It doesn't deal with immunity. It just makes it clear that lawsuits for negligence regarding the injury or death of children in state custody are not precluded by the existing statute.
Okay, so now we have conceptual amendment number one in front of us. Representative Seaton, do you still retain your...
No, I would remove my objection.
Okay, the objection has been removed. Do I hear any others? No. So amendment number one has passed. And do I... Representative Keller?
Could I move the bill?
We can.
Okay, I move that, whatever we got here. HB 354, version C, LS 1414C.
As amended.
As amended. Move from committee with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
There are more than one fiscal note, so.
Madam Chair, there is only one fiscal note, but it probably would be proper to say accompanying fiscal note because it is zero in 2009 and 2010, but there are fiscal impacts after that.
Okay, because, I mean, I've got several fiscal notes. Are they all the same?
You want to call an at ease?
Okay. Okay, at ease. So we have the motion before us. For House Bill 354, as amended, to move from committee with individual recommendation and attached fiscal notes. And hearing no objections, so moved. So we have now moved all of our bills out of committee that we had today. And I do want to announce that there will be no meeting on Saturday, the 8th of March. So if the members want to make plans for then. We kind of decided we're pretty much caught up for the people that and I think we can skip that meeting. So on the 8th, we will not have a meeting on the Saturday.
Chair, I don't believe in public displays of affection, but I could kiss you.
So if there's no further business, the meeting will stand adjourned, and it is at 4:07. Thank you very much.